from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, today's edition titled, Kocho Will Be Lucky to Get a Word in Edgewise, because we're starring Tom Sherwood and Bruce DePoit. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And thanks to you and Mark Seagraves last night for hosting a wonderful event involving Hacks and Flacks, journalists and public relations people, public information officers, for Bruce DePoit.
Well, you know, journalists generally don't care what elected officials think about us as long as we try to do our job. But it was nice to have a blending of the lines last night for elected people from Mayor Bowser to Ike Leggett.
Several members of the council.
To acknowledge Bruce's work for 14 years as the talk show host at News Channel 8, where he, how many shows?
About 3,300.
3,000 shows, and how many guests?
About 11,000.
11,000 guests. And Bruce has always asked tough questions, but he's much more polite than I am. That's what's his downfall.
Bruce DePoit is our guest analyst today. As Tom mentioned, he's the longtime host of News Talk on News Channel 8, from which he is stepping down. His final show aired earlier this week. And when they moved the time of that show from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m., it prevented Bruce from making appearances on this broadcast, which he used to do from time to time, because it didn't end till 12 o'clock when we were just getting started.
It's funny. No one remembers this, but a long time ago when the show began, we were on at 8 o'clock at night, and we were only on 4 days a week, and it took a little while to get some traction. They moved me to 4 p.m. I was on opposite Oprah 5 days a week for an hour, and still it was hard for people, even if someone came on and made news, it didn't always resonate because it was the wrong time slot. A former boss named Steve Chigaris, who's now at CBS doing a great job with their political coverage, moved the show to 10 a.m. and eventually moved to 11. But it was being on in the morning that really gave us the opportunity to. It was just a good fit. Guests would come on, they would make news, and it would very quickly work its way into the political.
And today, at least, your viewers' loss happens to be our gain. And I'm particularly happy to have you here today because in the first part of the broadcast, we'll be discussing Maryland politics. And even though your show dealt with national and international affairs, I still think of Bruce DePoit's strongest point as covering Maryland politics.
Thank you. I will say this. You know, some of us at Channel 4, more than a decade ago, tried to get our editors to hire him because I would say, even if he weren't here, that he knew everybody, and more importantly, had their phone numbers, and he knew the politics, and good, bad, and indifferent. And that's it's important for a reporter to be well-grounded into his or her subject matter, and there's nobody, even to this day, who is as well-grounded in Maryland politics.
Instead, we got stuck with Sherwood and Seagraves at NBC4, but that's okay.
It was a great party last night, and I'm really indebted to Tom and Mark for organizing it and everyone. Kocho, it was great to see you.
And I have to do the disclaimer, you know, my son is one of the owners of the Midlands at Bar on George Avenue, but I'd get none of the money, so I just want to make it clear.
I did see you behind the bar at one point.
My son called me back there to meet one of the
Joining
staff.
Us now by phone is Boyd Rutherford. He is the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And yes, a native Washingtonian.
Yes, and a graduate of Howard University.
There you go.
Absolutely.
If you have questions or comments for the Lieutenant Governor, you can call us at 800-433-8850. You can go to our website, kochoshow.org, watch the live video stream of the broadcast there, and ask questions or make comments. Shoot us a tweet at kochoshow or email to kocho@wamu.org. Bruce, since you are our guest analyst, I'll have you ask the Lieutenant Governor the first question.
Thanks for the honor, Lieutenant Governor. Good to speak with you.
Yeah, good to speak to you.
Give us a feel for what the administration is most optimistic about getting through the assembly this year. You work with an all-Democratic assembly.
Our majority, not all, but majority.
Of course.
And vast majority.
And so, there's been the predictable friction, but I think there's also some goodwill that folks can find common ground and move the needle on big issues. What are you most, not hopeful, but optimistic about?
I think we're optimistic on all of the pieces of legislation because that's just how we are by nature. I would say in particular our efforts with regard to opioid and heroin abuse and addressing those issues. We were very successful in terms of working with the legislature last year about that. And I expect that they'll work with us again this year to address this particular concern, because as you probably know, it's a big issue, not only in Maryland, throughout the country, but we're grappling with that challenge now.
Governor Tom Sherwood from Channel 4 here in Washington. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I watched some of the speech and the criticism afterwards, and the Democrats, or Sharon Baker from Prince George's County, the county executive, who many think is going to be running for mayor against Hogan next year, said that you guys made a mistake, and others said this, but by not the governor not talking about immigration and the national policy effect on the state, mm-hmm. and health care, what will happen if the Republicans on Capitol Hill and the president kill Obamacare or substantially change it. Aren't those serious issues for the people of Maryland?
They are issues, but the governor was consistent with his approach to the last two State of the States. He did not talk about national issues in the previous two. We didn't see a reason to talk about it this time. We were talking about Maryland. We're talking about the issues affecting us directly and our 33 recommendations that we have in terms of legislative proposals. So that was the focus. We can be frank about it. You know, we have a relatively popular governor in this state, and the Democrats know that. And they are trying as hard as they can to bring that popularity down. Last year, they played the race card. They tried to call the governor racist. They fell on their face with that. And now they know that the president is not popular in Maryland, so they're trying to link him as best as possible to the president.
What do you, as a political person, but also just as a citizen of the state, what do you think of President Trump?
I think he's president of the United States.
I do.
Maryland.
Is that it for emotional response to the president?
Emotional.
I mean, did you? I don't know. Did you vote for him? I know that I don't want to get. I don't want to replay last year.
Let's not replay last year. But if you look in the papers, if you followed what happens in Maryland, you saw that the governor nor I supported that right. particular candidate.
Let's ask something that really matters, because you're a former administrator at the Federal General Services Administration.
Yep.
You did similar work for Governor Ehrlich for that.
Yep.
In March, the Federal General Services Administration is going to announce whether Maryland or Virginia gets the FBI headquarters. What role have you been playing in trying to help the federal government bring that facility to Prince George's County?
Well, we've met with our federal delegation in terms of what issues may put us in a better situation to get the FBI headquarters. In terms of working with our budget, and explaining to some of our people internally and the governor's staff my understanding of how the U.S. General Services operates and how some of their decisions are made. And so that's been the role more than anything else.
You're going to be hopeful that it comes to Prince George's County.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. That's one of our priorities. We had a meeting with the federal delegation 2 weeks ago. And that was one of the six priority items that we outlined for them was securing the FBI headquarters. And we feel we have the best opportunity because we have two extremely good sites that are far better than what is offered in Virginia.
The new administration has so many issues on its plate right now and so much staffing still to do. Mm-hmm. A lot of focus, of course, on the prominent position, secretary, et cetera, but in the second and third levels of leadership, you know, that obviously is going to take time. What's your is there an expectation now that we could be months or years from a decision
They're saying that they're going to do it in March. We'll take them at that word. I think that a lot of the decision will be made by the careerists at GSA. GSA is mostly career population. And I think they'll make a professional decision in terms of what is best for the country, what is best for the taxpayers, and they'll find that Maryland has the best to offer.
You mentioned earlier that you and the governor were prioritizing the looking at the growing opioid and heroin problem in Maryland.
Yes.
What is the scope of the problem?
Well, the scope of the problem, it is growing dramatically. And for many years in Maryland, it has outpaced, in terms of the fatalities from overdoses, have outpaced that from automobile accidents as well as homicides. The governor, during our campaign 3 years ago now, pointed out that this was a particular issue that we needed to grapple with. And once elected, said that he would convene a task force, which he then asked me to chair, to come up with some solutions with regard to the problem. It is still rising in terms of the fatalities that are associated with heroin and opioid abuse. The numbers are up some 70% through the first 9 months of the year compared to the year before. But it's changing somewhat. When you start looking at these synthetics like fentanyl, and there are others that are coming in, that has more than doubled or tripled the amount of fatalities in the state associated with that problem.
Do you have a feel for the life stories of people who are going this route?
Yes.
Can you share?
Absolutely. Last year when we had our task force, we brought together experts and not so experts, but those from the prevention and treatment side, law enforcement, as well as individuals who are working in the area but have suffered either the addiction themselves or have a child or children that suffered, and in one case, had a fatality. We had six meetings across the state where we listened to the local officials, but also parents and families and individuals who've been affected by this problem. And, you know, we heard heartbreaking stories in a lot of locations. I visited a mother in Salisbury or just outside of Salisbury who lost her son, where the medical examiner would say he died of a heart attack, but in her view, he died from the drugs. That for so many years of using heroin and other opioids, that it just tore his heart apart.
One of the key aspects of your proposed legislation would be to limit the duration of prescription of opioids by doctors. What's the idea behind that?
Well, on the initial prescription of an opioid, Oxycontin, the Percocets, things of that nature. And the reason for that is that according to the DEA, 70 to 80% of the new heroin users are coming off of prescription medications. That's the big surge we're seeing, is that these are individuals who, in many cases, started taking the medication at the request or the direction of a doctor, and they were prescribed a large amount of these opioids, and before they knew it, they were dependent upon them. And so we're saying for the initial prescription that it should be no more than 7 days. That's in line with the fairly recent CDC guidelines, and we think it'll bring much more attention to the fact that you don't have to take the whole bottle of a 30-day supply of these opioids, and you can switch to something that is not going to be addictive.
Well, here is Christina in Woodstock, Maryland, who has a question about this. Christina, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello, Lieutenant Governor.
Hello.
I'm a patient at a 9-doctor rheumatology practice in Maryland, the largest outside of universities in Maryland. They uniformly say that this is interfering with the practice of medicine, that no one is going to be paying doctors to writing prescriptions every week. Many of their patients come from all over the state and out of the state. I'm 70 years old. I have lupus and other painful diseases. I can't take other painkillers because I have a bleeding disorder. I've never escalated my dose. Why should I be inconvenienced, if not irreparably harmed, and going to the ER for pain relief because of what a 25-year-old decides to do?
Christina, allow me to have Boyd Rutherford respond.
Yeah, let me respond. The proposal does not apply to you. It's for the initial prescription. If you've been already prescribed opioids in the past, this would not apply to you. This applies to the person who has a recent injury of some sort, a medical procedure or something of that nature, and the initial prescription is for 7 days. You've been prescribed these opiates for a period of time. This does not apply to you at all.
Thank you very much for your call, Christina, and good luck to you.
I want to go to on the politics hour, politics question. Mm-hmm. Bring me up to date, sir. This is Tom Sherwood again from Channel 4. Have you committed to being on the ticket again next year?
Have we announced that we're running again next year? I don't know if we have.
Well,
the governor is a very good friend of mine, and if he wants me on the ticket and if he decides to run, I'll be there with him.
Okay. You're a native of Washington. Do you remember, which hospital were you born in?
I was born in Columbia Hospital for Women.
Now it's a condo.
A condominium or something of that.
That's a perfect example of the change in the city. You're going to be 60 in April, is that right?
Oh, thank you very much.
April 1st. I've been checking up on you.
I'm telling you, there's too much information out there.
You're a Republican. The mayor of the city and the delegate Norton were up on the Hill this past week complaining that the Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, led by Jason Chaffetz of Utah, is trying to interfere in the local operation of the city government. As a native Washingtonian, but also as a Republican in a nearby state, do you think the district's getting a fair shake in how it's treated by Congress, or is it on your radar?
It used to be when I lived in D.C. It's not as much on my radar, but, D.C. Gets a lot of support from the federal government, which it should. There is not a large tax base in the city other than the private property owners, and you don't want to fleece them out of everything that has to be maintained in the city.
Excuse me to interrupt you. The city has a $13 billion budget. About $7 billion of it is from local taxes on businesses and residents.
Right.
And all the
the services are substantial, and the federal government has to pick up a portion of it, and they do.
No.
And
no,
you have a lot of universities, churches, and nonprofits who are not paying the taxes.
The District of Columbia stands on its own financially.
Okay, that's very good. Then we're just the question.
Well, there's another question, and one of that was raised by the chairman of the committee, Jason Chaffetz of Utah. But before I quote him, allow me to go to David on Rock Creek Parkway, who has essentially the same question. David?
Good morning, or good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I am the executive director and founder of a nonprofit called Douglas County, Maryland, and I was wondering if you would be so kind as to welcome Douglas County, Maryland, as the next county in Maryland, and to be receptive.
Glad you brought that up, David.
Douglas County, Maryland. That's a good name.
Because in the hearing, Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah suggested retroceding the residential areas of the district to Maryland, to which D.C. Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton responded, "Has the chairman ever asked anyone from the state of Maryland how they feel about that? So you're from the state of Maryland. How do you feel about the district being retroceded into the state of Maryland?"
Retroceded into Maryland. I think the district likes being independent, but I haven't thought much about it coming back to Maryland. I often tell people when they ask me, how could a guy who was born and reared in D.C. Be the lieutenant governor of Maryland? I said, up to 1800, it was part of Maryland. So that's an interesting concept, but it's not new. I think Newt Gingrich said something about that when he was Speaker of the House some, 15, 20 years ago.
Nobody's asked Marylanders about it.
Yeah, I know. You're saying with Maryland, this is congressional stuff. That's just rhetoric.
Mr. Lieutenant Governor, circling back to something that Tom broached earlier in our conversation, what did you make of the drama that played out over the weekend at the airports and just generally?
I thought it wasn't very well planned out. I understand new administrations coming in and wanting to take a look at security and the status of refugees, but I don't think it was planned out. It wasn't done well, and it created a lot of confusion.
Did it alarm you?
I don't know if I'd say it alarmed me, but I think it wasn't planned out well.
We got a Facebook comment from Juliet who says, why is your boss not only not responding re the immigration ban, but also deleting questions about it from concerned constituents on his Facebook page?
He has responded. In terms of the Facebook page, we do have a policy that from time to time, if it gets off topic, they may not necessarily respond to them. But, you know, you'd have to ask him those questions.
I want to wrap up the conversation about D.C. becoming back again and part of Maryland in retrocession. Only because of the way this district, because of suburban legislators, the district can't tax income at its source, which is a basic conservative fundamental understanding of government in this country. Maryland and Virginia each get billions of dollars a year from people who live in your state in Virginia but work in the district, and we don't get to tax them. But I can't imagine you would want the district as part of Maryland, because that would be 400,000 Democratic voters. You and Governor Hogan wouldn't stand a chance of winning. If you're an Eastern Shore Republican or a Western Maryland Republican, you would be shut out of your government. It would just be Baltimore and D.C. So that's why you shouldn't have D.C. come back.
Oh, so you're advising us not to take
it? Well, no, I'd prefer it be a state on its own. And
you just advised us not to take it. I mean, Maryland's current demographics in terms of political demographics are more than 2-to-1 Democrats and Republicans. So we've done well with Democrats who are looking at how to, you know, how best to maintain and manage the state, and so we would compete for all voters.
We wouldn't
necessarily take your advice on that.
I give you and the governor great credit for how you've managed your time in your campaign, your time in office, and what you'll probably do in 2018. I was just thinking, if I were a Republican in Maryland, the last thing I'd want is 400,000 more Democrats. But go ahead, thanks.
But speaking of Democrats in Maryland, let's talk redistricting, Bruce DePoit.
Thanks, Coach O. Okay. Lieutenant Governor, Maryland has one of the most tortured congressional maps there is.
Way to put it, tortured. You should see my district, my legislative district number three.
That's the poster child of really just. I would think that the average person, and this would be a fun exercise for listeners to this show to actually do, go online, Google the Maryland congressional map, and try to even find the third district. It's the leftover pieces that didn't end up in one of the other seven districts.
Right.
It's just this collection of odd communities, barely coherent as a district.
Yeah, there's no place where it starts and ends. I mean, if you assume it starts in Baltimore County, it runs through a piece of Baltimore City, then into Anne Arundel County, picking up a part of Annapolis, then back through Anne Arundel County into Howard County, going through Columbia, and into Montgomery County.
For some, this is a national conversation, because in states where Democrats control the process, they configure the lines to benefit them. In states where Republicans control the process, they configure the lines to their benefit. So
all just an excuse.
No, it's
it
not.
Really
well,
is. No, no,
not,
no,
not, not
no,
if
no,
you're facing
on,
the political
Florida,
reality.
No, hold on. Florida is a Republican state. It's got a Republican legislature and a governor. They went to a system where it's nonpartisan redistricting. California, under Democratic controls, they went to a redistricting process that took the politicians out of it. There are a few states Maryland and Texas that have done that, but we need to worry about Maryland and not worry about what Texas does or say, well, we're going to wait until Texas or Virginia changes theirs and then we're going to do it. That's just an excuse, a red herring. It's just excuses. Let's get off the dime. We are Maryland. We're not everybody else. Even though I read the Washington Post, we're not everybody else. We're not national.
There are states that have done more than others to take the politics out of it, but it's hard to take politics out of politics. And I'm just wondering to what extent there's creative thinking that can be brought to bear. Some have suggested having a state like Maryland partner with a state like Virginia to go forward together in a way that seems...
Jamie Raskin suggests that.
Right, seems to make it a little bit of an easier sell.
Congressman Raskin, I should say.
I mean, if we were going to take the politics out of everything, the residents of the District of Columbia would be represented. We wouldn't have this constant refrain of, well, it's another Democratic voting member in the House and two Democratic senators, which we know is the part of the bottom line reality for keeping district residents disenfranchised. So anytime
I mean, you're saying that, but you're forgetting the fact that the first 2 years of President Obama's administration, he had a veto-proof majority in the Senate, he had the House, and he had the presidency, and they didn't do anything about the District of Columbia.
Correct.
So, you know,
he did not.
These statements about just the Republicans have not wanted to bring the D.C.
Everyone has failed the city. That's correct.
Right. So let's be honest about that.
I know you have to go very quickly, so one final question. You can answer it quickly. President Trump and Republicans in Congress have vowed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. Maryland is one of the states which signed on to the ACN, which expanded Medicaid. What would the repeal of Obamacare mean for Marylanders?
Well, we want to make sure that the 400,000 people who now have medical care are going to continue to have it. We don't know at this point what's going to happen. We raised the issue with the federal delegation that it's really their job to make sure that our people are protected. The governor said, and I have said, that we want to make sure the parts that are working with the Affordable Care Act continue and that are good, but the parts that are bad, such as the increase in substantial increase in the premiums, some people being thrown off their policies, like myself, before being elected, are taken care of. So we'll see. We'll have to see, but, you know, it's in the hands of the feds to take care of this, and we anticipate that we're not going to be in a situation where those 400,000 Marylanders are going to lose their
Boyd policies. Rutherford, he is the Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Bye.
You're listening to the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. Bruce DePoit is our guest analyst today. He's the longtime host of News Talk on Channel 8, from which he's stepping down. His final show aired earlier this week. And joining us in studio now is Mary Chase. She is a D.C. council member who represents Ward 3. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, or good afternoon, actually.
If you have questions or comments for Mary Chase, call now 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the conversation there, or ask a question and make a comment there also. Tom Sherwood likes to say in his emails and tweets, local Washington is only as good as the people active in it. Well, a lot of Washingtonians apparently got active on the phone with Congressman Jason Chaffetz's phone this week, because the phone lines were flooded on Tuesday. And now if you call his office, if you're not from his 3rd district in Utah, you get put on another line. Ward 6 Councilmember Charles Allen decided to call Chaffetz on Tuesday morning to complain about garbage pickup, since the, I guess, implication is that Chaffetz wants to run the city himself. So,
well, if he wants to be a D.C. council member, we do have a qualifying period. He can do that and get off his sofa and where he sleeps on Capitol Hill and come down and run. But, you know, as humorous as that is about his interfering on that level, this week we're talking about the Death with Dignity bill that Mary Chase helped lead through the council. It was on the agenda for Thursday to have the House Oversight Committee essentially nullify the law. It was taken off the agenda yesterday. Do you know why?
I don't, but I do know there have been significant efforts behind the scenes through our delegate, Eleanor Holmes Norton, our mayor, and others to try to talk to Mr. Chaffetz and others about this. Now, whether this
he personally opposes the bill, he said so in an editorial
of
the Post.
Yes.
He's blocking it, not because he disagrees. He personally opposes it, as opposed to finding it wasn't properly vetted by the city, which it was for over a year.
Actually, more than a year. And that's exactly the problem here. Even though there is power under the Constitution for the Congress to control the affairs of the District of Columbia, it's an abuse of power, and it's arrogance to get involved in something that has been vetted thoroughly because of his own personal opinions.
Well, the congressman says that members are bound by a constitutional duty and obligation to oversee district affairs. You're both a constitutional lawyer and a council member in the district. Is there anything that the district can do about that?
Well, you know, we've been trying to pursue statehood, and that seems to have been stalled by the recent elections. But we have had home rule for many years.
73.
And the fact of the matter is the district is extraordinarily well run and, at least on our local level, operates democratically. We do have to fend off Congress from time to time when there are some hot-button issues that they want to involve themselves in. But I have to say, in the last number of years, it's been relatively agreeable in that much of what the district has done simply is not challenged by Congress. Though you're right, Kojo, the power lies there, whether it's an abusive power in terms of dealing with these issues, whether Congress should keep hands off, as it effectively promised to do with our home rule, is a separate question.
Right. The legislature, the article in the Constitution says the Congress has, quote, full legislative authority, unquote, over this district.
Plenary power.
And, right. But the Home Rule Act of 1973 was written, I don't remember the precise quote, but to relieve the burden of Congress from having to deal with the day-to-day operations of the local city. And that's what seems to be violated by Mr. Chaffetz coming, winging his way in from Utah, deciding that he doesn't like our law.
Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about initially about these calls and Councilmember Charles Allen, and we have talked about some of those things. But another one that a resident emailed to me said that, you know, our council should go out to Utah and declare that we're having hearings on matters involving local issues that affect people in Utah. And, we would rent a space, we would have a hearing, and we would hear about their complaints and maybe ask why he's not tending to those.
Set up a card table on some corner of one of its little cities.
Here's Bruce DePoy.
Lawmakers, thank you, Coach. Lawmakers score points back home frequently just by suggesting that something that the District of Columbia has done should be undone. If they feel like the substance of it meshes with the consensus viewpoint of the voters back in their district, even if the thing doesn't go anywhere, they score points. Over the last 8 years, President Obama served as a backstop against any of these things from getting too far if they were to generate momentum in the House and Senate. To what extent are you fearful that it's a more uncertain process, it's a more uncertain situation now with a Republican in the White House?
It's not only more uncertain, it seems more assertive, it seems more emboldened. And, you know, President Obama was a mixed bag for us, you might say. I mean, he was caught on tape saying that in terms of a budget deal, he would give the Congress control over whether we can support poor women's abortions. He was not really very much involved.
He kind of apologized for that later, but he did it.
But he did that, and it shows you the kind of indifference that even a Democratic president has had to the District of Columbia. So I'm not saying I wouldn't trade him in a nanosecond for the current president in terms of our issues, but I don't want to overstate his involvement or
a technical question here. In the case of the Death with Dignity, Congress is considering a disapproval resolution, a relatively rare move. First, what's the real-world effect of a disapproval resolution? And now, are we entering a new era in terms of how Congress is opposing district legislation?
Well, as you know, there are two ways for Congress to control us. One is via a disapproval resolution. A bill goes over to Congress. They have 30 working days to pick it up and to actually pass in both houses a disapproval, which would render it void.
Okay.
That's a heavy lift, you know, because one of the most powerful forces on earth, of course, is inertia. And so you have to pick it up and move forward with it. With our budget, however, what they can do, because they have to affirmatively approve our budget. So we send our budget over, and a lot of things are bound up in the budget in any case. And what they do is they have effectively line item veto. And so for years, they would, for example, line item veto the needle exchange. Mm-hmm. We would keep putting in, they'd keep line item vetoing it out. And then, you know, one year it came back and it was still there. And we went, oops, okay, let's not call anybody's attention to this. But things like that's an easy way. All they have to do is strike it as part of a budget bill.
Well, part of the problem is the lieutenant governor of Maryland was just on and made a reference of how essentially it's a federal city supported by the federal government.
That is not true.
I know it's $13 billion government, of which about $7 billion is raised by local taxes. I mentioned this to him. But there is this popular perception that Bruce just referred to, is that our local people, the 681,000, are mixed up in the White House, Congress. Washington, D.C. is a sinkhole swamp, and they don't understand that we actually raise the money from our own people.
And if that perception is shared by our neighbors in Maryland.
And, you know, there was a time where when David Catania was on the council, he had some connections with legislatures, and I remember going up to New Hampshire to ask them for a resolution in support of statehood. And then when we were in front of their committee that was relevant to this, they were asking us questions, but the questions had the predicate. Mm. Well, aren't all of the people in the District of Columbia just federal employees?
Yes, that's what people think.
Right, that's what people think. And in terms of the taxes, you're quite right. The majority of the money is raised by us, our own taxes. But even in terms of federal taxes, people should realize that we are among the top states in terms of the absolute amount that we send to the federal treasury, but we are first in per capita federal tax paying. I mean, that ought to be regarded
as... And we paid more in federal taxes than 22 other states.
22, yes. But we pay per capita, we're at the very top. For each person here, we pay more in taxes than anybody else in any other state.
This week, after your press conference, which you attended with the delegate and the mayor, I spoke to a very prominent Republican who happened to be over at NBC to go on MSNBC. And he's sympathetic to the city's plight, said he might even try to get involved and help. But he also said he thought the D.C. Council is now one of the most liberal legislatures in the country, and that he thought it would be better if this council, even if it passed whatever laws it wants to pass, if it stopped getting into a shouting match with Congress, because that's counterproductive, because it pushes them to get, you know, to push back, and that you can, some of these issues can be resolved, like you've referred to, maybe 25 other Republicans who come from states where there are death with dignity laws have suggested to the chairman not to go forward with this.
What did he mean by a shouting match? I can't think of one.
Them complaining publicly, denouncing Mr. Chaffetz and others, and he said it's not going to help them. It's like protests. It won't do any good. This is a legislative matter, and you've got to fight on the legislative thing, not on the streets.
Well, there may also be a middle ground. For example,
I think you need both.
Yeah,
you were on the Hill earlier this week, along with Mayor Bowser and Council Chair Phil Mendelson, to do with the Death with Dignity Act, which you co-introduced. Tell us what that meeting was like. Who was there? What came up? What came about?
Well, sometimes we do get the feeling, and sometimes it's actually true, that we're talking to ourselves, unless this message is carried forward, you know, for the rest of the country, to understand the degraded democracy that we have to work under, but also to understand the effects of that on the people in the district. And as I started to say, one of the possible middle grounds here actually is reflected by something one of my daughters did. She's a public defender down in Miami. And after Senator Rubio wanted to move forward on
gun legislation,
disapproving all of our gun legislation, and furthermore saying that we can never have any, she called me from Miami and she said, you know, I want you to know, Mom, that I called Senator Rubio's office. And I said, you know, I'm a constituent and I disagree with what you're doing. And actually, I was very pleased. I said, well, you didn't even need me to nudge you. And she said, I am your daughter, after all. But the idea is, and I've said this to people, I said, you know, we have friends, we have family all around the country. And we have, in terms of the Death with Dignity bill, there are certain groups that have a particular interest in that. We need to have folks energized to call and contact the congressional legislators and tell them that they don't approve of this behavior.
This is why I don't understand why the city has yet to put together a political action committee, separate from, obviously, not funded by the government, where you can organize people to do things like that. In the politics, you can make contributions to friendly legislators. You can rile up the other ones if you want to with just what you described. It seems to me there's no sophisticated mayor, council, community, business, labor, organization that can say, can fight the battles in the Congress.
And there are bipartisan firms, you know, that are purposely oriented around being able to deal with both sides of the aisle, that if you had that sort of money, you could engage. You have the relationships, the knowledge, and strategic expertise.
No, I agree with that completely. In fact, I had occasion to talk to you about this in the past, and I do agree with that completely. You know, it's somewhat at odds with a strategy of exclusively being quiet, taking a punch constantly, saying nothing but trying to work, you know, within Congress. There has to be a dual strategy,
right,
as far as I'm concerned.
The sweets and the streets, it was said,
right,
in the civil
right.
rights movement.
Well, here's a start. We got a tweet from Avery who says, next Politics Hour, live from Utah. Who knows?
Yes, okay, there you go.
How's the WAMU budget for that kind of travel?
We're going to investigate. Here, put on your headphones, please. This is Heather from Adams Morgan. Heather, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
My name is Heather, and I'm a consultant with the D.C. Senior Advisory Coalition, which is chaired by IONA Senior Services and AARP D.C. Our coalition had a very successful education day at the Wilson Building yesterday. We expected 50 participants, and almost 90 older adults showed up from all 8 wards. You chair the Transportation Committee. What do you plan in the FY18 budget to increase transportation choice and transportation access for older adults in D.C., especially those who don't easily access the Internet or use smartphones for transportation?
Mary Jane.
Well, you know, last year there was actually a cut, and it had something to do with one of the primary contractors who provided that service. We haven't yet seen the mayor's budget, nor have I even spoken to her about my priorities, but that is one of my priorities, to increase the transportation services, and we know how difficult that is. Now, to focus on one aspect of it and one aspect of it only, but I just want to make this point because it is important. We are also working on the front, which can cut into, you know, the issue about seniors, but it transcends that, into access to transportation, better access to transportation by people who are disabled. And so what we've been working with is our taxis to make them wheelchair accessible, and even with the app services to give them incentives to provide wheelchair accessible service. But to your main question, we're in the midst of the budget. That is one of my priorities, and we will be pursuing that.
You are the chairman of the
thank you for your call.
Transportation Committee. Let's talk about something that no one cares about.
Oh, good.
Parking tickets. on disability parking, incidentally, we've had disability parking, those blue and red meters downtown, have not been enforced. Now, after a couple of years, the Department of Transportation wants to enforce them only in the downtown section. When are we going to make that clear so people will know what those meters are for and will be enforced?
Well, they are rolling out their education campaign. I have asked the director of the Department of Transportation, you know, to really make that comprehensive, because one of the things that happened last time they attempted to roll out a quote-unquote solution is that people seem to have been taken unawares. And so I think there should be a more invigorated effort. But when it finally gets rolled out, the idea is to make everyone pay. It's like Arlington. All may park, but all must pay. But the red meters, it'll be the red meters, are exclusively reserved for people who are disabled, and they get double time. But the idea about everyone paying has to do with the rather excessive fraud that goes on with people with phony placards.
Yeah, on 10th Street at Lafont Plaza from Constitution Avenue, Independence Avenue up towards Southwest, that is day-to-day there are 100 maybe cars parked, all of them with handicap stickers.
Well, you know, there was a time when DDOT went out with cameras, and they started taking pictures of the placards, and word must have spread. And almost like an anthill emptying out, all of these employees came out because they figured that they would be discovered. And in fact, that's part of what showed us how rampant the misuse of these placards are.
If I may say so, as a district resident, these are mostly Virginia and Maryland cards.
That's right.
So they're not only cheating on the district. Now, there are some people without and who have disabilities that are not physically noticeable, so there
sure.
are people.
Right.
So you can't just say somebody able walking is not
right.
disabled.
Right.
But it, to me, it's an extraordinary failure to not enforce that.
But in other jurisdictions, like Arlington, where they've put in place, you know, paying for parking, they have seen a dramatic drop in fraudulent use of placards.
Good.
Bruce? I was in West Virginia with friends last weekend trying to just unwind and enjoy some time away. Never turned on the TV, but even a casual glance at social media provided a window into the drama that played out after the immigration situation unspooled and unraveled and became so chaotic and troubling. Given your background in the law, what was your reaction to that? All the people being held up, delayed, stopped, questioned, and then the outpouring with all that money flowing to the ACLU, that tsunami of money that they received, and the presence of so many people showing up to push back.
Well, what was most appalling, of course, is how it was rolled out. It looked like it was amateurish and not vetted by appropriate people, and as a result of that, real hardship was worked on families, whether it be children or mothers, fathers, students returning, other people returning to their employment. It was chaotic, and it was disturbing on a broader level to me, because if this is how we make policy and put out policy, we're going to have a terrible time around the world convincing people that we're not immature and act, you know, with hair triggers. And that's not a position you want your country to be in.
In the wake of the temporary ban on people coming from 7 Muslim-majority countries, the district has reaffirmed its status as a sanctuary city. But as a result, D.C. could lose, some say, $1 billion in federal money. Can the district risk losing that much money?
Well, first of all, we have to have a definition of what a sanctuary city is. I think that the executive order that was issued by then-Mayor Gray really did thread the needle on what we could do and what we couldn't do. We were not affirmatively obstructing anything that the federal government was doing. We were simply not cooperating, which is to say we would not go out and create lists of people who may be undocumented, and we would not attempt to find out, for example, let's say someone called and they were a victim of a crime, or they were reporting a crime, or they were a witness, or whatever. We wouldn't, as part of our inquiry to them, ask them their immigration status. So it was a kind of passive resistance. Now, when someone was arrested for a crime, of course, you want to run that person through the FBI files, and necessarily that information then is made available to the federal government to do what they will. But that was our approach. It was a passive approach. And so what is the definition of sanctuary city? Is it something more than that? Is it affirmative obstruction? And then second, there's this threat to take away funds if you remain a sanctuary city. Well, of course, Congress can always put conditions on funds, as long as it's otherwise not unconstitutional, for example, based on race or something, can put conditions, and you have to meet those conditions to get the money. We are a very long way away of, A, defining what a sanctuary city is, and, B, seeing what the consequence are. What funds? Are you going to take away Medicaid funds? What funds? So when they say potentially $1 billion, they mean government money in the form of grants that could be taken away. I don't think that we are going to even approach anything like a crisis anytime soon.
This goes back to the Republican who said maybe lower the tone of what's being done, not to stop any laws, but, you know, you could simply make these policies without trumpeting. I mean, I think Arlington has a very similar policy that you just described.
But some people are...
But it doesn't advertise itself as a sanctuary county.
But given the values that are...
2 minutes left.
Given the values that are at stake here, there's a significant desire to hear local elected officials express The values that their constituents by and large have.
No, absolutely.
Have, yeah, just, what you, just what you described is perfect.
Right, and we should tell them that. We should say, look, if you
there's a hunger for more than that.
No, but no, we should tell folks, if you need our help, or if we seek you out because we need your help, we are not going to mix that in any way with inquiring into your status.
Right. You want someone to call 911 in an emergency, correct, not do it because they're afraid they'll be
right,
arrested. Right.
And also, the district adopted the Real ID kind of license because we had been threatened by the federal government, although we've been threatened for years and years and years. Maybe we could have strung it out a little bit more, that if we did not do that, then you could not use that ID to access federal facilities. Who cares, perhaps? But you couldn't get on an airplane. And we didn't want to wind up in a position where folks who are here legally, citizens or whatever, would not be able to board airplanes because we didn't comply. So there are ways, and I think, Tom, you know, this is your point, there are ways for us to be as protective as we can of people who are undocumented, and we will be, without at the same time seriously jeopardizing the rest of the city.
You got 30 seconds.
Well, sounds
I'll
pretty good
it.
To me.
I'll take
but
it.
We don't know what Trump's going to do, right? We have no idea what Trump's going to do when it comes to city issues.
Right. Last week, you called on the Metropolitan Police Department to create a liaison unit for the city's Muslim community, mm-hmm, like those for Hispanic and LGBT residents. What's the idea? Shouldn't the entire force be trained to serve all community members?
Yes, but there are some there are some communities that do have special issues, and I think the Muslim community would qualify under current circumstances. You know, I taught a course on policing, and you know, I became pretty familiar with these liaison units, and they're very, very important. Again, this has to do with groups of people who we want to come forward, who we want them to understand that we will assist them, and also to train our police about special cultural issues that may make communication with them easier.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Mary Che is a D.C. council member representing Ward 3. Bruce DePoit is our guest analyst. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. Thank you all for joining us, and meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll be talking to the Maryland State's Attorney for Anne Arundel County about the region's opioid crisis. Until then, have a great, happy, and safe weekend. And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nand.
Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.